You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you're listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Rory Bradley. 13 lectures, entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life and the World. And this is the last lecture, Lecture 13, given in Dornach on May 2nd, 1915. Yesterday I drew your attention to the way in which the human being can leave the physical body with the higher parts of its organism, with the etheric body, the astral body, and the eye, and also to the fact that once we have left the physical body, we can undergo the first stages of initiation. Once we have done this, we come to the realization that what we call the spiritual activity of the human being begins not just once the human being enters into initiation. Rather, it is always present already in everyday life. We needed especially to emphasize that the activity by which our thoughts come to consciousness is actually carried out in the etheric body, and that this activity, which lies at the foundation of thinking and is carried out in the etheric body, is only then brought to consciousness through its reflection in the physical body. But it is carried out in the soul's spiritual element. The human being who is standing in the world and just thinking, truly thinking, is actually performing a spiritual activity. We could say that this activity simply does not come into our consciousness as a spiritual activity. When we stand before a mirror, we are not conscious of a face, but rather of the reflection of the image of a face in the mirror. So, too, are we not conscious of thinking in everyday life, but rather of the mirror image, the image of the thought reflected by the physical body. In the case of the will, things are different. So, let us think about this carefully. Everything expressed in thought is an activity that does not happen within the physical body, but rather entirely outside of it. It is an activity that is simply reflected by the physical organism. Let us consider the fact that we as human beings are actually always completely within the soul spiritual element. If we wanted to depict it schematically, we could do it as follows. And there's a picture. If this, A, depicts the physical being of the human, then thinking happens entirely outside of this physical part, and what we perceive as thoughts is reflected by it. So, in our thinking, we are always outside the physical body, and the spiritual knowledge of this really consists in nothing more than seeing that we are completely outside of the physical body in the process of thinking. Something different is true of will activity. Will activity really penetrates into the physical organism. What we call will activity goes completely into the physical body and generates processes there. And the result of these processes is what produces willed movement in human beings. So we can say that for as long as we, as human beings, are within the physical world, the basic energy of the will flows out of the spiritual element and into our physical organism, where it initiates certain processes that are completely contained within our skin. Between birth and death, we are filled by will forces, whereas thinking does not happen within our physical organism, but rather outside of it. From this, we can conclude that Everything related to the will is intimately connected with the human being's existence in a physical organism between birth and death. The will truly is connected in a very inner way with us. And all of the expressions of the will are tied up with our physical organism for as long as we live between birth and death. As a result, thinking really has a kind of liberated and independent character that separates it from the human being in a way that never happens with the will. Try for a moment to really think about the great difference that exists between thinking and everything that belongs to the will. Spiritual science is the proper tool for casting these intensive spotlights on certain riddles in life. Is it not the case that everything we can recognize through spiritual science basically just leads to the formation of questions that must indeed be answered? Think about this for a moment. Let us say that someone goes to a lawyer with some sort of case. The lawyer hears about the matter, and he takes the issue to court on behalf of the client. The lawyer will look for every possible clever rationale, and will be as clever as he can possibly be in order to win the case for his client. He will make use of every ounce of reasoning and understanding that he possesses in order to win the case. What would have happened, believe me, life will give you clues about this, if the opponent had managed to beat out the other man and had gotten to this same lawyer first? This hypothetical situation probably happens a good bit. The lawyer would have heard the opponent's side of the story and then gone to court with every bit of his cleverness and reason to defend that client's case, to defend it with pieces of evidence intended to do in the other person. I do not believe that anyone is inclined to deny that such a hypothetical situation might actually occur. But what does this hypothetical situation prove to us? It shows us how little the human being is really connected to his reasoning and his understanding with his thinking powers, because he is able to put them as easily at the service of one man as he could put them at the service of another. Now, compare how different this is when it is a matter of the will, when the person is engaged with his feelings and desires in a situation. Try to think clearly about whether a person who came to something out of his will would be capable of the same thing in a similar situation. On the contrary, we would say that he is not quite right in the head if he were capable of the same thing. A person is intimately connected with the will, very intimately connected indeed, because the will flows into the physical organism and directly causes processes in the physical organism that are a part of the makeup of our personalities. So we can say that spiritual science is capable of illuminating precisely those facts of life that appear so mysterious and riddle-like to our soul, if we simply sit and think about life. Spiritual science will continue to enlighten humanity about what happens in everyday life, because everything that happens is dependent on supra-sensory causes. The most everyday things that occur are just as dependent upon the supra-sensory and can be recognized only when we turn our gaze toward that supra-sensory realm. But now, let us consider the instance in which the human being passes through the gate of death with the soul. Here we have to ask, quote, what happens to the thinking forces and the will forces? Close quote. After death enters in, the thinking forces of such an organism cannot be reflected according to the same process that we otherwise use during the time between birth and death. The most significant thing to know is that this organism casts off everything that exists for us contained within the surface layer of our skin. So the thinking forces cannot be sent back by that physical organism. But the thing that initiated inner processes within that physical organism also goes away after one has passed through the gate of death, because that physical organism is simply no longer there. But the thinking forces remain, just as we continue to exist during moments when we can no longer see ourselves after we have stepped away from the mirror. During the period of time when we stand in front of the mirror, our face is reflected to us. If we were to step away sooner, then our reflection would also cease sooner. The thinking forces are reflected for as long as we remain alive in the physical organism, but they continue to exist even after we have left the physical organism behind. So, what enters in then? Thinking forces cannot be perceived in and for themselves. Just as the eye, EYE, cannot see itself, so too is thinking unable to perceive itself. It must be reflected by something. The physical organism is no longer present. So how will the thinking forces, which is to say, what they generate, be reflected if we have set aside our physical organism? Here something enters in that is not exactly native to current human understanding, but that we must understand if we truly want to grasp a life between death and a new birth. You can grasp this through the teachings of initiation. In initiation knowledge, even during life within the physical organism, the human being does not recognize itself through its reflection in the body, but rather through a reflection outside of the physical body by leaving the body behind and recognizing itself without it, shutting out the mirror of the physical body altogether. If you develop such knowledge in yourself, you will see how the thinking forces can come to consciousness outside of the physical body. They come to consciousness by having later thoughts reflected by prior ones. So pay close attention to this. When you are initiated and you leave your body, you do not perceive your thoughts by having them reflected by your physical body. Rather, you perceive them by having the thinking forces that you are currently sending out sent back to you by something that you previously thought. So you have to imagine that things you thought previously reflect the forces that are unfolding through thinking when that unfolding happens outside of the physical body. I could put it a bit more precisely. Let us assume that someone moves now into the state of initiation. How can that person then perceive something of his or her thinking forces in this state of initiation? The initiate sends out these thought forces, and they encounter something that was thought the day before. Those thoughts from yesterday are written in the general world chronicle that you know as the Akashic Record. And the things that today's thinking process generate are reflected in those previous day's thoughts. From this you can see that one is completely right to strive to make one's thoughts as strong as possible, so that future thoughts might be properly reflected in the thoughts from the day before. This is accomplished through intense concentration and various forms of meditation, as we have already described in various lectures about the knowledge of higher worlds. In this way, the thought, which is normally fleeting, become so condensed and concentrated within you that you will then be in a position later on to have your thinking forces reflected in these earlier concentrated thoughts. And this is also how consciousness is generated after death. Everything that you as a human being have experienced between birth and death is written spiritually into the great chronicle of time. And just as we cannot hear without our ears in the physical world, so too are we unable to perceive anything after death without the fact that our life and everything that we experienced between birth and death is written there into the world. This becomes the reflecting apparatus. I already drew your attention to this fact in my last cycle of lectures in Vienna. Our life itself, which we lead here between birth and death, becomes the sensory organ for the higher world. You do not see your eye, EYE, or hear your ear, but you do see through your eye and hear through your ear. If you want to perceive something with your eye, then you have to do so by way of external science. The same is true of the ear. The forces that you develop between death and a new birth are designed always to stream back toward the life that you have just lived on earth and to be reflected by it, to be perceived by the human beings who are living then between death and a new birth. From this, you can see why it is nonsensical to speak about earthly life as though it were some sort of punishment or otherwise something superfluous in relation to the whole life that human beings live. It is absolutely necessary in order to be able to perceive things, to have a kind of eyes and ears for the life between death and a new birth. We must be placed into these lives on earth because these lives will become the sensory organs that we need in the spiritual world during the life after death. The only difficulty that presents itself when imagining this is that when you think about a sensory organ, you tend to imagine something in space. But as soon as you move through the gate of death or into the realm of initiation, space ceases. Space has meaning only for the sensory world. What we are stepping into here is time. And just as we need spatial ears and spatial eyes here on earth, we need temporal processes there. These are the very processes that are carried out between birth and death that send back the capacities that we develop after death. During our lives, between birth and death, everything lies before us, perceptible in space. After death, everything happens for us in time, whereas before, everything was always perceptible in space. The particularly difficult thing when speaking about matters of spiritual science is that as soon as we turn our gaze toward the spiritual world, we have to unlearn the whole perspective that we have developed here for our spatial existence. We have to forget about that perspective and learn to recognize that space does not exist anymore and everything exists only in time. As a result, even the organs that we develop are temporal processes. If you want to orient yourself to the conditions of spiritual life, you not only have to learn something different, you also have to completely turn yourself about, remodel yourself, readjust your life, so that you gain a whole new way of imagining things. And this is the most difficult part, which I alluded to yesterday, and which causes so many to shy away, even if they have a very smart-minded philosophy about the physical plane of existence. People cling to their imaginations of space and cannot reorient themselves to the imaginations of a life that plays out solely in time. I am well aware that there may be some souls who say to themselves, quote, "But when I imagine my way into the spiritual world, I simply cannot imagine that this spiritual world has no spatial extension," close quote. This is certainly true, but it is far more important than anything else for us to make the effort to move away from the kind of imaginations that we use for the physical plane, if we hope to move into the spiritual worlds. If we imagine all of the higher worlds only according to the model and standards of the physical spatial world, then we really cannot gain any true thoughts about the higher worlds, apart from some fantastical, pictorial thoughts. The same is true in the case of thinking. Thinking continues after death in such a way that it is reflected in what we have experienced, in what we were in our physical existence between birth and death. These processes that we lived through become, in a sense, our eyes and our ears after death. Try to bring yourself closer to the meaning of the following sentence through meditation. Your life between birth and death will be employed as your eyes and ears. It will provide you with the organs that you will carry between death and a new birth. But what happens to the will forces? The will forces create life processes within us that lie within the boundaries of the body. They bring about life processes within us. The body is no longer there once the human being has stepped through the gate of death. But all of the spiritual surroundings are there. Just as the will worked its forces into the physical organism, so too it continues to stream out of the human being after death. It spreads itself out into its surroundings. This is the opposite of what happened in physical life, when the will worked its way more deeply into the human being. You will gain an imagination of this outward streaming motion of the will into its surroundings when you contemplate the things that you have to gain through meditation about the inner culture of the will if you want to progress in the area of spiritual knowledge. If you want to content yourself simply with understanding the world with your senses, then you will look around and see something blue, a blue surface, or maybe a yellow one. If you want to remain fully in the physical world, then this will be enough for you. We have spoken about this before. When you really want to have an artistic worldview, you have to get beyond this purely sensory understanding. For example, we need to experience blue as though our will, the forces of our heart-mind, were let loose into space itself, and as though the thing that streams toward us as blue could then stream back out into space, like a moment in which we experience devotion, as though we could actually pour ourselves out into space. Then the actual essence of blue streams in and flows outward again. But then, over there, where we encounter yellow, the will does not penetrate into it. It is pushed back. There we feel that the will forces are not able to penetrate and are actually pushed back against themselves. If you really want to prepare yourself to develop the soul forces that will lead you into the spiritual world, you must connect what I have just said with something real in your soul. You have to establish some sort of genuine connection with the fact, for example, that when you see a blue surface, you can say to yourself, quote, that blue is welcoming to me. It allows my soul to move together with it for a great distance. But this surface, which is yellow, pushes me back. In that case, my soul forces come back into my soul like the jab of a needle. Close quote. But something similar could be said of anything that you perceive. Everything has this sort of nuance. The soul forces of the will are poured into the world, and then can either be pushed back by that world or sink into it. You can develop this by schooling your soul forces with colors and other impressions of the physical world. You will find the details of this described in my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds. Once you have developed this, once you know how it feels when your soul forces become blue, parenthesis, to in quotes become blue is the same thing as saying that they are sympathetically taken up, becoming yellow is the same thing as saying that they are pushed back in a way identical with antipathy, close parenthesis. Then you have these forces within you. Let us say that you have experienced the soul nuance of being taken up sympathetically by something. And now you no longer encounter that something as a purely physical being. Rather, you encounter a spiritual being. And it might be the case that you and this other being experience that same sympathy, and the soul forces that you have developed flow into it in the same way. This is how we perceive the beings of the upper hierarchies and the elemental world. I would like to give you just one example, one that should not be taken as crude, but rather as entirely objective. You can develop forces not only in relation to your sense of color, you can also develop all sorts of soul forces. Just think of making an effort to feel self-knowledge, about how it is really taken up in the soul when one does something quite foolish. In everyday life, we simply pass over such feelings. We do not become conscious of them. But if you really want to develop your soul, you must have a feeling for the inner experience of doing something really dumb or foolish. And you will notice that when you do something foolish, soul forces of the will stream outward and can be thrown back at you by something. But they are thrown back in such a way that when we perceive the reflections, we mock and ridicule ourselves. This is an actual experience. If you pay attention to what happens when you do something dumb, you will feel ridiculed and mocked. And now you can develop the feeling of what it is like to be mocked by the spiritual world. Then if you go to a place where there are the kinds of nature spirits that we call gnomes, you will have the power to perceive them. You gain this power only by developing the feeling that I have just described. The gnomes behave in such a way that they are always mocking, making all sorts of gestures and grimaces, laughing at you, and so on. But you can perceive this only when you observe yourself in moments of feeling foolish. It is a matter of gaining intimate powers through these exercises of immersing ourselves in our surroundings with our will. Then our surroundings will come alive and be truly living. So we can say that while our life between birth and death becomes an organ of perception in the spiritual organism that we inhabit between death and a new birth, our will becomes a participant in the spiritual surroundings that envelop us. We can see how the will streams outward, both in initiates and in those who have died, for example, in the seeing of gnomes. And if you see gnomes, this is as an example of the elemental world. Now, think about the fact that there was a philosopher in the second half of the 19th century who made a big impression on many people, Schopenhauer. As you know, he had a big influence on Nietzsche and on Richard Wagner. Schopenhauer traced the origins of the world, as others have done, to other origins, to what he called will and representation. He said that will and representation are what lie at the foundation of the world. But then, influenced by the Kantian way of thinking, he went on to say that representation is always nothing but a dream image, and that you can never penetrate through that image to reality. The only way to get through to reality is through the will. The will leads us to the reality of the thing. Schopenhauer went on to philosophize in an impressive manner about representation and will. He is always on firm ground, so to speak. But he is also one of those people that I described as walking up to the gates, but then remaining outside of them, not going inside. If you actually take him at his word, then the world is merely a representation, and it is also merely a dream image. And you can then refrain from trying to recognize the world in the representation, but still recognize the representations themselves for what they are, and do something with them in their own soul, in your own soul. In other words, meditate upon them, concentrate on them. If Schopenhauer had gone one step further, he would have said, quote, I must dispense with the representation. If it is merely a product of my inner life, then I have to make use of it internally. Close quote. If Schopenhauer had taken this step, then he would have been led to further cultivate the representation by reworking it through meditation and concentration. And when he said that the world is will, indeed, when he started to describe the will in the natural world, parenthesis, as he did in the brilliant treatise titled On the Will in Nature, close parenthesis, he did not take his own statement seriously. When he described the will, he made use of the representation as an aid, and this denies all of the power of knowledge. This is the kind of foolish idea that is the equivalent of grabbing yourself by the hair to pull yourself out of the swamp. What would he have had to do if he were going to take his statement, quote, the world is will, close quote, seriously? He would have had to say, quote, all right, so that means you have to pour your will out into the world. You have to use your will in order to slip into the things themselves. You have to immerse yourself in the world and send your will out into the world so that you experience the color blue, not merely as a representation, but rather attempt to feel how the will immerses itself in it. You need to experience your own dumbness, not merely as a representation, but rather experience it in such a way that you can take up the things that can be experienced in this process of doing something foolish. Close quote. You see again that it is possible to arrive at a spiritual aperçu, an aperçu that needs only to be taken up seriously. Readers aside, the word is A-P-E-R-C with a little mark underneath the C-U. A-P-E-R-C-U. And a reader's aside. Aperçu. If Schopenhauer had gone on, then he would have said, quote, if the representation is really just a represented image, then we have to work with it internally. If the will is truly in things, then we have to immerse our will in the things, and not merely describe how the will lies in things. Close quote. Here again you see an example of how a significant philosopher of the 19th century led us right up to the gates of initiation, and then did everything in his power to close and lock those gates. Whenever you really take up life, you will see signs everywhere that the time is ripe to pluck the fruits of spiritual science. We need only to take these matters very seriously. Above all, we must learn to take people at their word, for spiritual science is not at all destined to defend its own correctness. The others, that is, its opponents, do this more than anyone else, but they are not aware that they do it. They have not an inkling of that fact. Let us take a certain sort of person who was very commonly found in the 19th century. An atomic materialist. One of those people who believed that at the basis of all the appearances of life lay the movements of atoms. Who thought that behind the visible and audible world was a world of atoms in motion. And that these motions incited processes that we perceive as the sensible world. There is nothing spiritual in the world. The spirit is simply a product of atoms in motion. The processes and effects of atoms are all there is. So where did this idea of swirling atoms come from? Did somebody see them? Did somebody discover them through an actual experience of them? If that were true, then the atoms would not actually be the very thing that they are supposed to be, something that exists behind the experience of the world. If they have a reality, how are we supposed to find them? Let us assume that these atoms in motion do exist. Our reasoning cannot parse them out from the sense perceptions that we have. What would human beings need in order to be able to speak about this world of atoms? They would need to have clairvoyance. The whole world of atoms must be a product of inner vision, of clairvoyance. And we could simply turn to the materialists of the 19th century and say, quote, "We do not need to prove that clairvoyance exists, because you must either stop propagating your theories or admit that you are clairvoyance, or able to perceive these things, at least to the extent that you are able to perceive the atoms that move behind the sensory world. For it makes no sense to speak of the materialist world of atoms if the powers of clairvoyance do not exist. If you think it is necessarily the case that there must be a moving world of atoms behind the sensory world, then you are proving to us that clairvoyance exists." Close quote. This is what it means to take people seriously, even when they themselves do not take the things they say seriously. If you take Schopenhauer seriously, then you would conclude, quote, "If you say that the world is will, and that our representations are nothing more than images, then you have to submerge yourself in the world through the will, and dive into thinking through meditation and concentration. We are taking you seriously. You, on the other hand, do not take yourself seriously." Close quote. On a fundamental level, this is the case for all similar things that come under this kind of consideration. Herein lies one of the deeply significant aspects of the spiritual scientific worldview, that it takes seriously the things that others do not take seriously, but treat only superficially. The proofs of spiritual science are always to be found in its opponents. But people do not notice that their claims and the things that they think simultaneously negate the very thing that they imagine they are claiming or thinking. The claims of Schopenhauer and of the atomists negate the very things that both seem to want to claim. Schopenhauer negates his own system with his claim that everything is will and representation. But in the moment that he refuses to embrace the one he seeks to move beyond, he stands at the brink of leading people into spiritual scientific development. We are not the ones who form the spiritual scientific worldview. How does this spiritual scientific worldview take shape? It enters in and is to be found everywhere in the world. It enters into life through unknown gates and windows, and it will find its way into the cultural life of humanity, even if others do not take it seriously. But something else can be recognized when such considerations really lead us to see how little human beings are immersed in their own spiritual processes, and how little they really take themselves seriously, even when they are brilliant, serious philosophers. People weave a sort of fabric of ideas and representations, but they shy away from doing any sort of true inner work with the fabric of ideas that would further their experience with the fundamental forces of the world. So it is that we see, and again we mentioned this yesterday, that over the centuries, the great triumphs of natural science are simultaneously the things that have led people to a very superficial way of thinking. The more glorious the developments of natural science, the more superficial this research into the very origins of existence has become. We can find some truly shining examples of this very thing. Let us assume that we have a person who has spent a period of time unconcerned with the spiritual world, but who then experiences a transformation that causes him, suddenly, to care about the spiritual world, to develop a desire to know something of the spiritual world. Let us say that we experience this when we are immersed fully into spiritual science. What would be needed in the case of this person who has shown little interest in the spiritual world, but who now, at a major crossroads in life, turns toward the spiritual world? It would be interesting to know what is happening in the soul of such a person. Whenever possible, we would try to enter into the soul of such a person, and it would be useful for us to know, as I have often said here, that the often used saying, quote, nature makes no leaps, close quote, is completely false. Nature makes leaps everywhere. When the green leaf becomes the colorful petal of a flower, nature has made a leap. And when a person who has shown no interest in the spiritual world changes so that he suddenly is interested in spiritual science, this is also a kind of leap. And we would do well to find out what has caused it. We will gain some information about the various spiritual wellsprings that we have often spoken of here, and we will see how something like this could occur. We will ask ourselves, how old is this person? We know that every 7 years, something new is born in human nature. At the age of 7, it is the etheric body. At the age of 14, the astral body, and so on. We will then take everything that we know about the etheric body and the astral body, and so on, and that means we will take it up inwardly and not externally. Then we will be able to gain some information about what is happening in such a human soul. You could also proceed differently. You might become interested in the fact that people suddenly move from an external life into a life that is interested in spiritual truths and religious depth. A person might consider spiritual science to be a foolish fantasy, and when you conduct research into that person and the processes that are playing out in his soul, you might find what induces him to consider it so foolish. But then you could do the following. You might write, let us say, 192 letters, or even more, to people who have supposedly undergone such a transition. You could write letters to people all across the continent, and ask them to respond by describing what brought about this change in their lives. Then you would receive all sorts of answers. One person might say, quote, when I was 14 years old, my life led me into all sorts of excesses. My father grew angry about this and trounced me thoroughly, and he beat me into a feeling for what the spiritual world is, close quote. Another might say, quote, I saw a man die, close quote. So, just assume that you have received 192 letters in response, and you lay them out in stacks. You make one stack of letters in which the author says that he or she took up these things out of a fear of death or of hell. Then you make a second stack, in which the author says that he or she is imitating or following in the footsteps of someone they consider good. And you make another stack of another type of letter, and so on. You often have to group things together loosely for these stacks. Then you make another stack for people with other egocentric motives. And now you have these results. You have sorted the 192 letters. You have counted up how many letters there are in each stack. And now, with just a simple calculation, you can say what percentage of people had each type of motivation. For example, you might find out that 14% of people make this sort of change out of fear of death or hell, 6% because of egocentric motives, 5% because they have been gripped by some sort of altruistic feeling, 17% are striving after some sort of moral ideal, probably the sort of connected with the Society for Ethical Culture, 16% because of a crisis of conscience, 10% because they are following the teachings of someone they consider good, 13% because they are imitating someone else whom they consider religious, 19% because of social pressures or needs, and so on. You can also proceed by trying to lovingly immerse yourself in a soul that has gone through this change. You can attempt to conduct research on his or her interior life. For this, you need spiritual science. Or you can do something like what I have just described. The person who did this is a certain Starbuck, and he has written a startling book about such things. This is the most extreme version of an externalization of the matter. It is the opposite of what one must have a feeling for in spiritual science. Spiritual science always attempts to penetrate into the interior of things. The tendency that has arisen in this materialistic age is to take up even religious life through the use of the famous and beloved techniques of statistics, for this is, quote, unassailable research, close quote, as we have been shown all too clearly. It has a quality that is loved by those who do not want to go through the gates of spiritual science. One can truly say of it that it is easy, very easy. We already mentioned yesterday why so many people do not want to turn fully toward spiritual science. It is too difficult for them. Statistics, on the other hand, are easy, truly very easy. Now these days, people are also conducting experimental soul science. I have to tell you a good bit about this experimental soul science if I am to really give you a concept of it. It is called experimental psychology. People think it has a lot of promise. I will describe to you only the beginnings of what people have started to do with these experiments. Let us say that we have 10 children sitting before us, and then we write a sentence on the board in front of these children, something like this, quote, TH ellipsis, HA ellipsis, WO ellipsis, Y ellipsis, ACC ellipsis, LO ellipsis, close quote. Then you take the clock and say, quote, you tell me what you can read there, close quote. The child does not know at first, but he thinks about it for a while, and then it comes to him, quote, through hard work you accomplish lots, close quote. And then you make a note of how much time it took the child to come up with the sentence. You need to have a lot of sentences ready, obviously, because it can be challenging to come up with something like that. Over time, the children will be able to do it more quickly. Then you make note of how many seconds the first one needed and how many seconds the second one needed to complete the sentence, and so on. Then you figure out the percentages and do further work with the data statistically. In this way, you can test their adaptability to external factors as well as other things. This methodology in experimental psychology has a stylish name. It is called intelligence testing, whereas the earlier methodology I described was called, quote, testing the religious nature of human beings through experimental means, close quote. You see, my dear friends, the things that I am presenting to you here in a few broad strokes are really nothing to laugh about, because there are far more philosophy positions open to those who are working with this future discipline of soul science than there are positions open to those who take seriously, even in a small way, the things that are discovered only through the inner observation of the soul, not to mention the things that we talk about. In these times, you have to be able to conduct experiments. These are some examples of the kinds of experiments being conducted now, and they have widespread support in the world. Physics and chemical laboratories are being built. There is an endless literature on the topic. Indeed, you can experience it for yourself. I will mention this just as a short aside. A friend of ours, one of the members of one of our northern branches, applied to write his doctoral dissertation at the local university. He made every effort, of course, just as one adjusts one's speech when speaking to children, to meet them at a level they can understand. He made every effort to leave out everything that he had learned and gained from spiritual science. All of it was left out. But now, at the defense of this dissertation, a man was on the committee who was an expert in these things, who had his finger on all of these different methodologies, so to speak. He did not accept the dissertation at all. This is a case that the Storting in Norway is already dealing with. The committee member, who is an experimental psychologist, is firmly convinced that he is standing firmly on the scientific ground of the present, and that the future belongs to his soul science. Nothing in particular should be said against this experimental psychology. After all, why should it really be uninteresting to experience the kinds of things it has to say? To be sure, it is actually quite interesting. There is no reason why you cannot do things that way. but it is a matter of how these things are brought into life, and whether they are used to kill off true spiritual science and genuine knowledge of the soul. We must always continue to stress that we do not want to deny the work of others investigating the soul by examining the sensory world and registering responses using methodologies like the 192 letters. This befits the capacities of the researchers. But we must keep in mind the nature of the world into which spiritual science is now stepping. We must be clear about this. I am well aware that people might come forward and say, quote, "He is at it again, complaining terribly about experimental psychology and picking it all to pieces," close quote. People could just as easily say, quote, "You insulted Goethe and his Faust around Easter time and picked it to pieces too," close quote. People who cannot understand that describing something is different than the kind of criticism practiced in the usual sense of the word will always misunderstand such things. By describing such things, I hope to place them within the collective whole of human life. Spiritual science is not meant to practice criticism, and what it says cannot actually function as criticism. It is another thing to have clear vision. And this is how someone looking toward science can arrive at the insight that science actually externalizes all of human striving, even when it comes to religious matters. It does not look inward, but rather considers humanity from without. In practical life, people are not quite so credulous. The statistics of the insurance agencies can calculate approximately when a person will die. I have mentioned this before. In other words, you can make calculations for an 18-year-old boy and estimate when he will die, because he belongs to a group of people in which so and so many die within a certain number of years. After that, the agency makes the insurance quotes, and they are distributed quite properly. This all works out well. But if that same person were to then be preparing himself in everyday life for the year in which the insurance agency said he would probably die, he would be considered a fool. The system does not determine anything about your life. Statistics have just as little to do with your religious beliefs. We must learn to see all of these things. By doing so, you will struggle your way toward a feeling in which intuitive knowledge can be found. But it will be particularly difficult to bring what I would call the pinnacle of our spiritual science into current world culture, that is, the knowledge of the Christ. Knowledge of the Christ as the purest, holiest, and highest thing in spiritual science is what everything in spiritual science is leading toward. In many lectures, I have attempted to make it clear that precisely in this age, the Christ impulse, which entered through the mystery of Golgotha, must awaken the soul into a state of responsiveness through the instrument of spiritual science. I have tried to make the various workings of the Christ impulse clear in many different ways. Just think about the lecture on the Maid of Orleans, or Constantine. In many different ways, I have tried to make it clear that the Christ impulse has moved through the centuries in the unconscious, but that now we are living in a time in which it must step into human life much more consciously. This is an age in which a true knowledge of the mystery of Golgotha must enter in. You will not be able to learn to recognize and know this mystery of Golgotha unless you truly take up and immerse yourself through spiritual science in the ideas and imaginations that were touched upon at Easter, the concepts of Christ in connection with Lucifer and Ahriman. We are living in an extremely difficult time, in a time of great pain and suffering. You know that I cannot say something descriptive of these times for the reasons that I have already mentioned. I do not want to do that either. I want to touch upon something from an altogether different angle, something that is connected with what we are discussing today. This time of pain and suffering has awakened something in the human soul. And all of us who are experiencing this time and are concerned about what is happening will notice that in this age, a great deepening of the human soul is coming in from one side. It is a deepening of the human souls that are standing in the midst of these current events and that have distanced themselves from all religious life, where the sensibilities and feelings have become totally materialistic. But in the messages we receive from them, through letters and other means, we find that through their painful connection with these current events, they have begun to rediscover their religious feelings. It is characteristic of this moment that people who would never have let such words cross their lips before are starting to talk about God and a divine order. It is really true that you can experience a great sense of religious deepening on the part of people who are experiencing these things firsthand. But another fact can be called up that is just as clear as the one I have just mentioned. Take a look at the characteristic passages from the letters that come from the battlefields, the one in which you can find this characteristic deepening of religious feeling. They write a good bit about how they have found God again. But they also say almost nothing, and few people have really noticed this, about the Christ. We hear them speaking about God, but not about Christ. This is a very significant fact. A religious feeling is on the rise in this time of great pain and suffering. Of great suffering and pain. A religious idea in the abstract form of the idea of God. However, we almost cannot speak at all of a similar deepening of the sense for Christ. I say almost. Naturally, we see it in a few places, but generally things are as I have just described them. From this you can see that our age is at a point where human souls feel a need to seek a connection with the spiritual world again, but also that it is hard for us to be led to what we call the Christ impulse and the mystery of Golgotha. This is why it is necessary for the human soul to be given an imagination of the whole of humanity. This is why it is necessary that we not only seek community with the things that we live with during one lifetime, but also that we turn our spiritual eyes toward all of the ages and all of the beings that we have been and have been with, as souls throughout several lifetimes on the earth, several different ages, during several different ages. This leads us gradually to understand the powerful necessity in our souls to recognize that humanity undergoes descending and ascending periods of evolution. We must feel at one with humanity in its evolutionary process. We must look back to the moments of Earth's origin and witness its descending and ascending stages of evolution, at the middle of which stands the mystery of Golgotha. We must feel at one with all of humanity and feel at one with the mystery of Golgotha. The human soul stands closer to the spatial cosmos than to the temporal cosmos, the temporal cosmos being the one that has unfolded during the course of the stages of evolution. But we are led to the temporal cosmos when we start to feel united with the whole course of human evolution. For once we begin to feel this, we cannot help but see that a certain moment of human evolution came about at a point when something entered into human evolution that could not have come about purely through human powers. It had to enter human evolution by having an impulse from the spiritual world itself penetrate into the world through a human body, which happened at the beginning of the Christian calendar. It was a moment when heaven made contact with the earth. Here we are touching upon something that must be incorporated into religious life through spiritual science. We are talking about the way in which spiritual science must sink into the feelings of human beings so that they come into connection with the mystery of Golgotha and find the Christ impulse in such a way that it is not an unclear feeling for them, but rather they will have it as a clear consciousness that cannot be lost. Spiritual science will work. We have recognized the necessity of this work, and we have often stressed that at a basic level, you all are sitting there as a way of demonstrating that you want to work with your whole heart as part of this spiritual scientific movement. And if in the future hard times befall humanity once again, then may it be the case that spiritual science will have found a way for this deepening of the human soul to connect not only with an abstract consciousness of God, but also with a concrete, historical consciousness of Christ. The time has come in which serious feelings can be roused within us, and we should not avoid calling up such feelings, which I would say are actually holy feelings. Let all of those who have become a part of this spiritual scientific movement be differentiated from those who have not yet approached it by the fact that all of the people who have committed to spiritual science take up everything that happens in the world with a fundamental sense of seriousness, both the external things and the deeper ones. Consider how important it is to see in everyday life that with our ordinary reason and intellect, which is bound up with our nervous system, we are actually outside of what most interests us in normal physical experience. Because of this, we are actually strangers to ourselves in our thinking, as it is typically practiced, say, by the hypothetical lawyer we mentioned earlier. But by working with spiritual science, we acquire a heart, quote, outside of the body, close quote, as we mentioned yesterday, and what we think will again be filled with inwardness and soul quality. Only in this way can we make use of the reasoning and understanding that are bound up with our physical body and thereby deeply connect ourselves with the spheres in which we actually practice our thinking. Through spiritual science, we will carry this out. And in the things that we think with our reasoning and our understanding, we will become people of truth, and life needs people of truth. What shines from the sun of spiritual science grows together with us, because we grow together with the beings of the upper hierarchies. We must become people of truth about through spiritual science. Only then will our thinking become such that we do not use it like the lawyer who is capable of defending either side of an argument. We will become people of truth by becoming one with the spiritual truths. And insofar as we are able to find the possibility of grasping our will in the way that I have described today, we will find the path into the inner parts of things. Not by speaking as Schopenhauer did about the will in nature, but by living into things with our will, and intermingling our will forces with those that are in the thing itself. Here we touch upon something that is sorely missing from our present moment, the loving act of immersing oneself in the essence of things. This is so sorely missing from the present. I would say that you really need to keep experiencing the bitterness of this, the fact that the practice of allowing one's will to sink into the essence of things is so sorely missing. If I present to you an apparently insignificant fact, you will not be understanding it properly if you think that I simply want to make a personal remark. It is not meant as a personal remark, and could, in fact, be of some significance for certain things that are a part of our considerations currently, even within our circle here. To be sure, I really do not like having to make such remarks. And if I were making it only as a way of showing that I myself find something to be unnecessary, then I would not be making it. But over time, a certain perspective, a certain sensibility, must spread ever more for the seriousness that must become a guiding part of each one of us. There is no need for anyone to feel offended when I say something like this. I am not saying it for personal reasons, but rather as a way of pointing out that we must all remember to take up this seriousness that must become an integrated part of our movement. For precisely at a place like this, where it is possible to establish this building as an external sign for what we are doing, it is very important that the proper sentiment be the rule for everything that cannot exactly be said, but which must be felt and understood by every single person who is to be a part of our movement. You see, I am not fond of touching on these matters here in this place. After I attempted, during the first months of this difficult period, to bring one thing or another to the souls gathered here, certain things happened, I will just leave it at that, that made it utterly necessary not to speak another word, even an objective one that might be fitting to our movement. I can honestly and rightfully admit that this is a fundamentally painful thing, and that it is truly painful to feel such a great number of misunderstandings pulsing through our movement. I mention all of these things because they are connected with the question that must be addressed here today. The question I am addressing is how much we are strangers to ourselves in the act of thinking, and why exactly this is the case. It is not enough if we simply take up in our thinking the things that bubble up from the spiritual scientific perspective. We must take up these things that emanate from spiritual scientific sources in such a way that they move into our will. But this will, I mentioned already how it is intimately connected with what pulses in our life, this will is more recalcitrant than the thought. The portion of spiritual science that can be taken up in thinking is taken up very little. But the portion that is supposed to move into the will is generally quite misunderstood. Is in general greatly misunderstood. I, in particular, have had to experience this quite painfully. Out there in the world, people are talking about a kind of belief in authority that is supposed to be predominant here among us. But actually, much in here is misunderstood and ill taken up, because very few have been able to see how carefully this knowledge that I am presenting has been gathered and gained. Now, I do not know how a brochure written by a certain Mr. Church found its way to me yesterday. But if it was sent to me by the circle of our anthroposophic friends at Arlesheim, perhaps with the intention that I should read it and see what some people are saying about our current state of affairs, then I must say, even if it does not necessarily apply to this example, it does well to others, that if this brochure was indeed sent to me with the idea that I should take from it the knowledge of what someone else thinks as those thoughts are expressed in that brochure, then I find the act of sending it to me both out of place and inappropriate. I say that without criticism. If the brochure was sent to me by way of offering an example of how people falsify history, then that is another matter. But not everything is done with this intention in mind. This is all I would like to say about this brochure, in which someone has written some assessments of current events that are based on nothing more than the most frivolous sort of falsification of history. This is something that we must absolutely and completely overcome, the falsification of objective facts. But this falsification is also something that is practiced so often at present. Someone who knows nothing about what is happening makes claims that can be easily shown to be false. Someone like Mr. Church, who should not be allowed to speak when serious matters are considered by serious people. When something like this is said, my dear friends, it should be taken as a kind of example, and not as something leveled against this particular instance, which is ultimately totally insignificant. But this particular brochure is a symptom, and we should think about symptoms like this, so we might go ever deeper into the depths that must fill our spiritual movement. and our spiritual movement will serve as a guiding light in the soul, particularly when we familiarize ourselves with what cannot be found by those who are in the midst of these most difficult current events, seeking for the values of the spiritual world. Spiritual science must gradually build for us the steps that will lead to a permanent understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. This mystery of Golgotha is what gives meaning to the earth. And understanding the meaning of the earth must be the greatest task toward which spiritual science continues ever to strive. That is the end of Lecture 13, the end of the book, Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life in the World, 13 Lectures, by Rudolf Steiner, Collected Works, Volume 161, translated by Rory Bradley.